dip, but the, woke up early this morning anyway, so I got 6 miles in.
Should be easier to keep a jogging habit going in Massachusetts than in Texas, I would think, where the temperature might be a little bit over the humidity.
You find that it's not much of a problem. I've run in 110 degree weather, 113 actually. I've run 113 weather.
Is that right?
Uh-huh.
How far did you run?
6 miles.
Is that
yeah.
right?
Mm-hmm. Once I ran in a little over 100, it's about 106 in Kota Baru, Malaysia. And which is really, it's a very bizarre place on the east coast of Malaysia. It looks right across from Vietnam, across the bay there, and all that. You can't see it, but it's, I don't know, 100 miles or something. But and there, I got dizzy. And I thought, this is not smart. I mean, it was high humidity, 106 degrees. And I went about 6 miles. I was in those days running 6 miles a day every day. And I was thinking, geez, this is not smart. Here you are in a foreign country. No one knows where you are. You're out on a road. You are dizzy. I mean, you know, I was in my 40s. So I decided, you know, it'd be a good time to start adjusting my habits around jogging and that to a little more, at least let people know where you are. But I'm pretty consistent about it. Up here, it's actually harder because in the winter, it's dark. In the morning, it's dark mm-hmm. after work. Mm-hmm. And the roads out where I live are narrow. And so when they plow, it's narrower. Mm-hmm. And your real hassle is not to get hit by a car. Mm-hmm. You know, so are you running?
I used to be, so yeah. I developed arthritis in my hip.
Oh, that's too bad.
Yeah. I lived in New Hampshire for a while when I first went into journalism, and the winters there, it was almost fun to run for the cold, but
some
the issue was just the same, that the roads were narrow and the cars were...
If I lived in the city, it would be great, because yeah. I don't, but if I did, you could run along the Charles regardless
yeah.
of the weather.
It's a terrific
and be great, and it's flat, which is also helpful if you're a runner. And, you know, that'd be great, but I don't. I live out here, so it's convenient for it.
Still running every day?
Oh yeah, I miss a couple days a week usually because of travel or commitment or, you know, some problem. But let's see, I've been at this now 22 years, and my goal, I'm getting close to my goal here. My goal is I'll be 55 in September, and I want to run 50,000 kilometers by age 55, and I'm very close. I'm about 400 or 500 kilometers away.
And have you done a marathon?
Uh huh. Yeah, I did one when I was 41 years old. In Dallas, the Dallas White Walk Marathon, and I trained very hard for it, and I was very pleased with my time. I ran 3 hours and 7 minutes.
Wow.
Which, for a 41-year-old's first marathon,
that's very good.
I was real pleased, and I was so pleased that I decided, you're not going to do better than that, so don't. This is going to be your marathon. And one of the smart things I did, actually, well, one smart thing is trained really hard. So I'd run 301 miles the month before. 2 months before, I ran 250. 3 months before, I'd run 200, so I was well trained. Now, the other issue was after the marathon, I went home and dictated all my memories of that particular experience, and I still have it. And it's great because I could pull it out, it's 4 or 5 pages typed, and it's just great. You can relive the whole thing, you don't have to do the work.
So, well, you could have carried that voice activated
they didn't have it then, yeah. Oh. But at that time, I was just carrying, I would have been carrying a rosary if I was carrying something. I wanted to be sure I was going to finish, you know. But I learned a lot on that particular deal. I learned how to run a marathon and finish strong as opposed to weak and worn out and all that.
Well, we love marathon metaphors up here around Boston.
Well, I frequently use that. I missed one, but I've been to all the others since I've moved up here in 86 just to watch. And I've used that in talking to employees that this isn't a sprint that digital's on. This is a marathon. It's a very long race, and so the important thing is consistency, perseverance. If you've run a marathon, during the race you'll have doubts. There'll be times during the race you'll have pain. You have to run through it. You have to be confident enough that you've done the necessary training, you've built the foundation, and you know you're going to complete the race. And completing is winning. Now, you have to complete within a reasonable distance of your time goal. Everyone has one that's appropriate for themselves. It's not realistic for a company of this size and the trouble we were in to expect to turn around much quicker than we're doing it. If you go back and look at Fortune 50 companies, which we have, the last 10 years, digital is unique in terms of the number of gross margin points that we suffered in decline. It was the largest of any of the Fortune 50 companies in the last 10 years. and 22 percentage points, actually. And you look at that.
Who's second?
IBM with 21 points. And what's interesting, for the same reasons, because the computer industry changed with the advent of personal computing in the mid-80s and with the advent of open systems and Unix, but IBM fell from roughly 60% to 40, which leaves a lot for a profit. Digital fell from roughly 50% to 30, which with our cost structure, of course, engendered large losses. But in both cases, we had to restructure our companies, IBM and Digital. Digital also has restructured more of its assets as a percent of total than any other company in the Fortune 50 in the last 10 years. So 38% of the assets have been restructured. So keeping in mind the magnitude of the challenge and the fact that it is a marathon, don't look for a quick fix, train for it, put the foundation in place, make sure you've thought through what you're doing. It's very similar. You know, in a marathon, you need to have the water stations. You need to take a little nourishment along the way if you want to finish.
But in this case, it's as if you came into a marathon already underway and the digital wasn't running so well.
Actually, unfortunately, we were not on the right road. I mean, it's if you think about it, we just were not on the right road. The thing that made this task somewhat more difficult was that we started very late. You know, we were very late to the starting line. If you go back and look, I got graphs and charts if you want to see them. Digital, Hewlett-Packard, IBM, and several other companies, Compaq. We had very similar profiles in 1987 in terms of gross margins, although IBM's were the highest in the industry, and expenses. And the companies were remarkably similar if you look at graphs. What happened is as Unix began to make its inroads into proprietary operating systems, as Microsoft began to be more and more successful on the Intel architecture and displacing a lot of the traditional proprietary systems, our competitors begin to work on their cost structure. Digital, on the other hand, continued to, in fact, accelerate our investments in field infrastructure. Our engineering budget grew without limit, practically. And we behaved as if 87 going forward would be as good as 80 going to 87. It turned out that if you look at our competitors on these graphs, it's very clear they started working on the cost, that we didn't actually start working on it until the 90s. This made it a much more difficult race. In any marathon, you'd like to start when everyone else starts.
When I ran the Boston Marathon, I was a bandit, which meant that I was started at the back of the pack. Yeah. So I didn't cross. By the time I got to the starting line, the leaders were roughly a mile and a half away.
In my case, they would have been anyway, given how fast the leaders run these days. I'm particularly impressed by the fact that if you look at the women runners today in marathoning, the winner will have run 26 miles faster than I've been able to run one in my lifetime. Right. You know, I can't sprint 1 mile, and I'm not slow. I can't sprint 1 mile as fast as she's run 26 miles. Very impressive. Never mind the males.
Right. As I recall, when John Kennedy became president, one of the things he said was that his biggest surprise was that when he found out what was going on inside the White House, that things were just as bad as he'd been saying they were.
Mm-hmm.
When you took over, were there any major surprises, or did you have a pretty good sense of just how difficult the race was at that point?
I would say that it was more difficult than I anticipated, in that it was obvious to me, having been part of senior management for a long time, that changes need to be made, particularly in the cost side. It was obvious that it was widely being printed in various publications that we were the least productive of all those systems companies on any reasonable metrics, and it's just factually we were. We employed substantially more people to accomplish the same revenue as any other competitor. So that much was obvious to me. I'd already been, as Vice President of Worldwide Manufacturing Logistics, I'd already been downsizing manufacturing, so I knew that there was more of that had to be done. And interestingly, the plan that we put in place in 1990, maybe 91, but that time period on manufacturing, which was to go, is a quite closely held plan with the top of manufacturing, to go from 35 plants to 10, that plan has been completed. And it's the same plan. It's amazing, really, when I think about it, that we were, before I got this lofty position, we were already working on that piece. So I knew that would have to go on and it'd be painful. I didn't really fully appreciate the amount of restructuring that'd be necessary, and I think it's safe to say that no one else did either. Certainly nobody on the board that I'm aware of expected that we would be able to, or need to, reduce the population in half, reduce the number of square feet from roughly in half, actually less than half. A number of manufacturing plants from 35 to 10 was expected. But when you look at all of this, half the people, 10 plants instead of 35, less than half the square feet, five times as many computers being manufactured. So there's some productivity gain in there somewhere.
I went back and looked at some of the clips from around the time that you took over, and the radical analyst perspective was that digital had to cut 30,000 jobs.
Yeah, that was
and
radical.
In fact, you cut twice as many.
We had to cut twice as many. And I think, actually, 30 would have been probably my expectation at that time. And in fact, it was that lack of appreciation as to the depth of the problem that led us to somewhat inauspicious 1994. You know, like, we had a very good start. In the first four quarters, we improved the operating expenses of the company compared to the previous four quarters. Let's say the losses were improved by $840 million. So it was a huge start. And the stock responded, went up, and all that. We reorganized the company around the industry focuses, tried to align our business by industry. We began to attack the infrastructure in various countries. But we stopped focusing on reducing the population and the people, facilities and that. We didn't continue that focus. If we'd fully appreciated the magnitude of the problem, I think we would have continued that. It became very evident this time last year when we had a very surprising and very poor financial result in Q3 of FY94. And that led me to rethink fundamentally what's wrong. You know, I was really surprised because we'd already taken out more than 20,000 people. We had maintained the revenue, which is unusual. If you go back and look at, again, Fortune 50 or Fortune 100 companies that have been in turnarounds, there's only two or three that were able to maintain revenue while doing a restructuring. I'll give you the revenue came from a different source. I was growing the PC business and losing the proprietary VAX business. And one, the VAX business is far more profitable, so it was a difficult transition. But we were able to maintain revenue. But I was outrunning, thinking about what fundamentally is wrong here. My background's physics, and in physics you're looking really for the fundamental first principles that drive the various things that you observe. The first principle here was, and it occurred, was quite clearly, and I've talked about it a year ago, that digital's implementation of large functional groups that are then connected with our field and with each other by matrix management structure and hierarchy and overhead was just not responsive enough for the new environment and was too costly. And that led me to realize I had to organize by a much more product line focus, and I had to separate these things into business units and eliminate the infrastructure that connected the previous digital. This is hard to overemphasize in terms of cultural change. The company had existed for more than 35 years with a different model. We always had change in digital, like any company. It's a living organism, really, always changing relative to your environment. We were always changing and making improvements and doing well, but we had consistently had a high reliance on consensus, lots of debate, lots of time needed to reach any decision. A matrix structure grew up around that. That was all very successful when product life cycles were multiple years. And we engineered every piece of the vertically integrated computing value proposition. It's totally inappropriate to the 1990s.
You didn't really come to the conclusion that the matrix system had to go until
Q3. And it was actually a few weeks after that because I was still thinking what happened. You know, since we hadn't forecast, none of my business units had forecast the outcome that actually occurred. So it was clear that we were not structured in a way to get at the data. And also, it was also clear that I couldn't hold anybody accountable. You know, in the previous structure, because you had this large functional engineering, functional sales and marketing, functional manufacturing, you really didn't know where to go for an integrated plan. And it was also obvious that the units that had been run differently, which I set up quite consciously separately, the PC group, there you could see measured progress. You could say, gee, I know what they spent, I know what the return was, I know what the loss was, I know what the sales growth was. It's pretty manageable in my storage business, which was semi-autonomous. We could see that, gee, Charlie Crist was making great strides in repairing that business, turning things around, reducing costs, growing the revenue. Things were reasonable, you had a strategy, and you knew most of the pieces. There was some interrelationship. Semiconductor was almost standalone, and of course, I'd run that myself. And I'd run that quite autonomous from the rest of digital, sometimes for a good deal of criticism. But in any event, we had 5 years of never missing our deliverables or ever missing our budget. So you look, and by the way, my successor, Ed Caldwell, has yet to ever miss his budget. And so I'm saying, gee, he's been at it since, I don't know, 4 or 5 years now, 5 years. So I'm saying, gee, I prefer people that make their numbers, and I prefer a system where I can tell who is responsible if you don't, or what needs to be done to help the person achieve their objectives. And so all of that kind of came together in the reorganization that we pulled off last July, which was a monumental restructuring of the company. And since that time, of course, we've downsized, unfortunately, another 26,000 people, I guess, year over year. 26% is 22 to 3,000 people. And we're now down to about 63,100 people worldwide, which is not far from what we think is the appropriate size given our revenue.
Were you worried at all after Q3, given the extent of the surprise
absolutely.
To you, that you just weren't going to be able to do it?
I was absolutely worried. Well, actually, I went into it knowing that you might not be able to do it. People ask me sometimes, well, how long did you think before you accepted the position? Nanoseconds. It was phrased to me, if it were offered to you, would you accept it? And I said, if it were offered, I would gladly accept it. Because for me, the opportunity to make a positive contribution was so enormous. I mean, we didn't talk about salary, we didn't talk about when, we didn't talk about, it's just, if it were offered, would you accept? Absolutely. I'm not so dull as to not know, and having been part of senior management for a long time, to not know that it was serious. And articles that were being written at that time, as you observed, a headline on one of them, I remember quite well, I think it was Information Week, said, "Will digital survive?"
Right.
I mean, so I knew I was taking on a high-risk occupation. I also knew that if it does fail, you are the failure person, and your career is damaged, probably irreparably. I didn't even worry about that. The issue for me was, what an opportunity. And besides that, I love the company. And I felt like I could do better. And we were a better company than our financials were reflecting. And I still believe that. And so I felt like, boy, this is an opportunity of a lifetime, a privilege. So you absolutely accept it. But at the same time, I'm realistically enough to know that it was quite possible that we had waited too long to begin to address it. Many analysts thought we had waited too long. There were articles as recently as last year where they said, gee, it was too late to save it, or this management wasn't smart enough, or something. But in any event, that it wasn't going to be saved. And I can assure you it wasn't from lack of hard work by our employees or the management team.
Well, is there something, given where things seem to be now,
mm-hmm.
and given what you've gone through in 2.5 years,
yes.
is there something that you would have done differently?
Oh, yes, absolutely. If I were all-knowing and all-seeing in that, I would have bought the stock when it was 18 and a quarter. And lots of it. Lots of it. I already had quite a bit, but I would have bought a lot more. I didn't. I bought some with my own money. That's one thing is to get stock options. Another thing is to take your after-tax dollars and buy it, as many other people did. In the, I think my price is somewhere around $36 or $7. And for me, it was a lot of money. But in any event, open market. Yeah, I would have bought a lot more last summer. You know, we were up about 150% from the low. So fairly impressive vote of confidence from the investors. And when people vote with money, that's a pretty serious vote. So I would have done that. But seriously, answering your question, I would have kept the downsizing pressure on in 1994. In 93, we were very focused. We were cutting out the fat. And of course, it's easy. It's like losing weight. If you're obese, losing the first 30, 40 pounds may not be that hard. I've never been obese, so I don't know. But if you were, I think, yeah, 30 or 40 pounds, probably not so bad. The next 30 or 40, a little harder. And the last 5 or 10 are hard for all of us. We never quite get that last 5 we intend to get. And so I would have kept the pressure on. And as I look back on that situation, I realized that I wish I had come to understand the difficulty of the matrix management system that we had here in terms of making rapid decisions and being responsive enough to the marketplace realities. It took time to see it. Now, on the other hand, I've thought about this a lot, as you can imagine. If I had gone to the structure we had today, to be fair, I didn't have the talent to do it. The first year, one of the things I'm most proud of is the quality of the talent that I attracted into digital. If you think back on digital, 3 years ago, it was a very insular company. Almost all of the management had grown up in New England, which isn't bad, but there were no representation from outside this area. Half our business is in Europe. There was no Europeans at the table. Today you have three of the most important business entities run by Europeans. Half your business is there. Might be a good idea to have some Europeans on your top management staff. Your person running Asia Pacific might be a good idea if they were Asian, as they are today, or as he is today. So I'm very proud of the fact we attracted talent, we brought in the talent, and then you have to have a little time to figure out who's going to make it and who isn't. So that had to take place anyway, and I spent 93 and part of 94 in that process, hiring new people, giving them a chance to perform, dealing with the issues as needed, and I'm very pleased with the team we have today. It's an extremely competent team and working well, as demonstrated by the financial performance.
Is there something in your performance in the last 2.5 years, other than perhaps not seeing the depth of the problem so quickly, that you're not so proud of, that you made a mistake or you took a wrong road?
Well, yeah, there are any number of mistakes that a person makes in making a leadership position. The worst mistake I've ever seen in a leader, and I have seen it, is the person that's not capable of making a decision and seeing it through. I don't suffer from that. I also don't suffer from some kind of egomania here that I don't know that I make mistakes. Of course I make mistakes. The issue is, as you make a mistake, can you recognize it quickly, and can you act to rectify the damage that's been caused by that mistake? Can you fix it? If not, at least can you get some help? I mean, what can you do? The issue for any leader, whether it's a government leader, political leader, business leader, in my view, is to take all the available data. You can't wait till you have perfect data. You can't afford it, especially in our industry, which is quite rapid moving, perhaps the most Darwinian and competitive of any industry. You have to take the available data that you have, integrate that data, look at the alternatives that might be relevant, make a decision, and go on. When you make an error, correct it. So I can say there are any number of errors that I've made and any number of good decisions as well. I like to talk about good ones, especially publicly. So I tend not to dwell on negatives in my lifetime. I've been fortunate to have a number of challenges, and I learn from them and go on. And you just don't dwell on the negatives.
How do you receive bad news?
I'm relatively, I think, balanced in the way I receive it. In the first place, nobody likes to receive it. So I'm not going to sit here and tell you that I like to have my flaws pointed out. However, I've learned that one way that you can grow and continue to increase your ability to contribute is by listening carefully to those criticisms and thinking about it objectively. I think I was very fortunate to work for a very tough cookie a few years ago when MossTech, one of the companies that I've worked for, in fact one I helped found, was acquired by United Technologies. And the team that I was familiar with, that I've worked with for 13 years, or let's say 10 years, got replaced by new management. And the new manager was a very tough cookie. And I remember that although it turned out he promoted me to executive vice president, so I was assessed as the highest performer in the company for management anyway, that although I won that distinction, it was painful. Because when we had our merit reviews, he was not bashful in pointing out, okay, Bob, here's the 4 or 5 things you did well. Now let's talk about your shortcomings. I mean, he was not bashful. And I'd go out of there typically just mad and frustrated, and then I'd go for my run, and I'd think about it, and I'd say, you know, he was right. And his name's Hal Ergot, and he did me a big favor. And I would think, you know, he was right. And what am I going to do about it? Because fundamentally, being mad about it's not very productive. So you think, there's an opportunity for me to improve my capability to be a leader, to grow as an executive, and I need to work on this. And I thought it was invaluable. Now I try to provide something of the same help to people that work for me. I deliver my messages a little more tactfully than Hal delivered his, but maybe he was more effective. You know, I don't know.
Is he still with United Technologies?
No, I don't think so. I think he's retired, and I think he has a company of his own, actually.
How do you spell his name?
Ergot.
When you look...
Might be two T's, Ergot. It's been a long time. I think it's one.
Okay.
But anyway, it's not material. I think that the issue here is fundamentally, how do you receive the news? You receive the news hopefully thoughtfully and try to learn from it and listen. One of the difficulties you have as you move up the ladder and that sort of thing is I think some executives lose the ability to listen to criticism. That's a serious shortcoming.
Yeah, you see that in a lot of organizations, companies, and government as well. But if a leader can't hear bad news, that just means the bad news piles up unacted on.
Well, you also get a situation where if your response to bad news is very negative, then after a while people stop giving you any news. So you have to be open. Now, digital has, fortunately, the technology that enables us to actually listen to our employees on a worldwide basis over our network. We have one of the largest private networks in the world. And we have bulletin boards called the Notes File. And we have information going all the time by various people questioning the direction of the company or commenting on the company's management or on decisions that are made. And it's very easy for you to see, well, what do people think about things?
Well, that makes me want to ask how the employees have received the bad news up to this point.
Well let me say, if you were asking, about things that I've learned and so forth, and also some things that I'm sort of proud of. I mentioned one of the things I was really proud of was the quality of the talent that we've been able to attract here and get deployed and the leadership that they're providing. But I would say that even more than that, the thing that I'm most proud of is what our employees have responded, how they've responded to this challenge. It's incredible. You know, worldwide, digital employees are so dedicated to the company, it seems. They're so appreciative of the good times that they understood that something had to be done. In fact, it was interesting to me that management used to worry about, well, how will the employees receive this news? The employees had known it long before management knew it. Employees were on the front lines in the inner guts of the company. They knew things were not going well. They knew we had too many people and too many expenses. They could see that we were not efficient. They could see we were not well focused. They understood all that long before management did. Employees were more than willing to make sacrifices to help the company turn around. And I would say that I'm proudest of our employees, of all the things that I've experienced in these 2.5 years, which have been, let me say, fairly difficult 2.5 years. We have excellent people. I wish we had more. But it was necessary to get to this size.
There was a piece in the Wall Street Journal 2 days ago about how companies now are cutting even when profits are high because companies have to run a little faster. Mm-hmm. If you use a marathon metaphor again, have to run a little bit faster and a little bit harder to stay ahead, and so you don't wait to shed weight or to train until you fall behind.
It's a never-ending process.
Is there a way for you to assess what the changes of the last 2 years, including all the bad news and all the cuts, have meant to the morale and to the culture of the company?
Well, yes, you can. We do several different ways. One is the notes file that I mentioned. That's a sample, like a statistically valid sample, but only a sample. I get out personally and talk to employees a lot. Wherever I go on customer visits or worldwide, I always try to schedule town meetings with employees, and you get sometimes several hundred, sometimes 30 or 40, and have a dialogue with people. And that way I ensure that I'm still listening and that they have a chance to hear it from me directly. And they have a chance to talk to me directly about how they feel about some things and try to understand, you know, how does some of the stuff we've decided up here play out in their local geography. So that's another way. Third way is we have an employee survey on a worldwide basis that's run by our communications group that looks at employee attitudes about a wide number of questions. And the intent there is to make sure we have a professional, ongoing way to build up a base. How do people feel? Not surprisingly, they didn't feel very well the first time we ran that survey. We were slashing in employment dramatically and costs. Now that we have a foundation, now how do we improve that morale? How do we work with our employees to help turn things around? As I mentioned, they have been outstanding in their attitude and their willingness to do whatever was necessary to turn the company around. My belief is that management has a responsibility as we become profitable, as we can afford it, to share some of those benefits with our employees. We recently announced, for example, in the United States, where it's relevant, that we are going to have a matching program for our 401k participants. We've never had that before at Digital. And what we've said is that employees are permitted to save a percent of their salary, as you know, by law, in a pre-tax basis, and that can grow to help them with their retirement. Digital will match 2% of their contribution up to the first 6%. So this is saying that one-third, I should say, of their contribution up to the first 6%, so 2 percentage points. Share in with employees. Never did that before. My intent is, as we become more profitable and as we continue our turnaround here, to have more such programs for all employees, various geographies or different laws and whatever, but to share the benefits. And I think that that's a responsibility that I have. I also, of course, have a responsibility to the shareholders to make sure that they're receiving value. And it's a balance that you have to run.
Has there been something unalterably broken in terms of the traditional old
sense of...
I
hope so, because when I came to Digital in 1985, I was quite shocked that even in the semiconductor group, there seemed to be a feeling of entitlement. And I found it very unattractive. Now, I'm from Texas. Texas has kind of got a Wild West cachet. I was an entrepreneur. I had a real strong belief that you are entitled to compete. You have an opportunity by virtue of good fortune if you're born in this country to access the venture capital if you have a good idea and an opportunity to compete, and that also means an opportunity to fail. One of the things that's very important about capitalism, it only works if you actually are allowed to fail. And one of our problems with our government, which is a whole other subject, is sometimes they forget that and they want to have all of the benefits of capitalism without the costs. Doesn't work that way. In Digital, I was quite surprised to find that people felt they were entitled to raises, entitled to benefits, entitled to flexible work hours, entitled to this, entitled to that, and I found it quite unattractive. And since semiconductor was my responsibility, we set about changing that right away. Some of my first speeches, I remember the first slide, and the first slide said entitlement. And I would give a lecture on how it's going to be in semiconductor, at least, and it was and has been. And the issue for me is I hope that's forever broken. I hope employees understand that it is impossible for management to guarantee your job. We are not a government. We cannot print money. The only person that can guarantee employment is the customer, period. My employment or anyone else's employment. Because at the end of the day, the customer is asked to and has to pay for all of the expenses. So unless we can create real value in our products and services that customers are pleased to pay for, we cannot guarantee anything. So the idea that you have a guaranteed employment is something that needs to be expunged from the consciousness of the enterprise, and I think it has been. On the other hand, management does have a responsibility, in my view, to create an environment where people can grow personally, individually, professionally, gain new skills, apply those skills to add that value for the customer, and they can have a lot of fun doing that. People that are not motivated in that manner need to work at a different company, because this is not going to be a socialist enterprise.
You mentioned the responsibility you have to the shareholders.
Yes.
How far are you, or is there a way to characterize the distance that you have to go at this point to give them what you, in essence, promised you were going to give them when you took over?
We're doing better, but not adequate. We're, as I said, given that if you look at, and I have studied this rather extensively, companies of this size that got into serious trouble, we are well on track with the best of them that ever turned around in terms of our turnaround. And if you look at relative to the Fortune 50 companies, which we were prior to the Fortune's new list, if you look at that, Digital has had to overcome more of a challenge than I believe any other company in the Fortune 50. So that if you keep that in perspective, I think we're doing very well against that environment, that boundary condition. When do you achieve enough success? Never. You know, you find your world-class marathoners, when they finish the race, the reward is they get to run the next one. I'm not interested in take it easy time. It's not my nature. And it's not the nature of Digital Equipment Corporation. We want to regain a position of true industry leadership. We have it in some places today where we didn't have. Now we do have. We want to be a broad-based leader in distributed computing of the type that's most commonly referred to as client-server computing, network distributed computing, heterogeneous networking. We're doing the right things in our strategy to ensure that we are that leader technically as well as financially. Today, our financial metrics are much improved, but not good enough. And so I'll just keep raising the bar. So it's not a situation that I'm ever satisfied. It's not my nature to be satisfied. And my belief is the CEO shouldn't be satisfied. If the shareholders wanted somebody that was satisfied with the status quo, they'd just leave him in there.
Is there any likelihood that you're going to redefine what your core competencies are?
Well, we are in the process of redefining them, but actually, I don't think so. We spent a lot of energy examining carefully our portfolio of skills, services, technologies, and products. And it was quite an extensive process, more than you've got time for today, but you can make a book about it in terms of how we approach that problem. And at the end of all of that work, we have, I think, a relatively fair assessment of where we're pretty strong and capable, where we are weak and shouldn't be competing, because as Jack Welch likes to say, if you don't have a competitive advantage, don't compete. If you don't have it or can't get it, don't compete. And in the areas that we are quite good, like in the areas of architecture, areas of networking, semiconductor microprocessor capability, software that enables heterogeneous computing, things of that nature, we are quite focused, and we need to turn those into returns for our shareholders. So we have a large number of competencies, but we are focused on a much smaller set than the ones we're trying to pursue.
But you're satisfied, at least at this point, that you've got the right mix of competencies?
I am at this point, but let me be quite clear that the world is, and the company is, and the industry is dynamic. And so my expectation is we will gain new competencies that are relevant to the world of computing that's developing. For example, we're developing new competencies in object technology, in mobile and wireless computing, areas that we're investing for the future, in interactive multimedia. We have some competencies there, but we're adding to those competencies. But those are very interesting examples. Like if you talk about interactive multimedia, digital has won more than half of all of the trials on a worldwide basis that we're aware of on video on-demand servers. So whether it's a trial or a full-scale deployment, like in the case of Ameritech, we've been very, very successful. And you look at, well, why? Largely it has to do with our competencies around architecture. It was, how did you design an open system for video on-demand support, a platform, and powered by the world's highest performance microprocessor, excellent storage, RAID arrays with an appropriate storage hierarchy, to be successful for low-cost video streams, the total systems engineering job. So digital has competencies in all of those areas, architecture, systems engineering, microprocessors, storage, and by putting it all together, you have a platform that's winning hands down in the marketplace. And we need to look for other applications.
Well, something like interactive media is sort of a risk because the payoff is relatively far off.
Well, the payoff is growing rapidly. The payoff is far off for the purchasers, you might say, of those systems. Like, you could decide to go into the content business. We are not. You could decide to go into the wires business, that is, the fiber optic to the home or telecommunications business. That's not our job. Mm-hmm. And as I look at the paper every day, you see new alliances being formed between such companies to exploit interactive multimedia. That's not digital's role, but our role is to provide platforms to any of those, and all of them if we can, alliances that attempt to look at that market opportunity. So whoever wins in that, I'd like them to be winning on digital platforms. So the opportunity for digital is a lot greater. Some of them will fail colossal failures. You know, even so, the opportunity for digital to provide platforms to the winners is quite large.
In terms of the technology bets that you're making, mm-hmm. I need to ask about Alpha.
Sure. Alpha is the engine that enables us to have the widest portfolio of performance of any of the computer systems companies. We have two architectures here. The Intel architecture, which is a world standard, you know, it has probably 80% of the desktop, something like that. Digital has a complete line from that laptop on my desk over there all the way up to departmental servers and dual and quad configurations. But in addition to that, we have Alpha workstations all the way up to supercomputers and the new TurboLaser we just announced, which are incredible technology. Digital was the first to go to 64-bit architecture, and we have undeniably had the highest performance microprocessor for the last 3 years. That's unprecedented, by the way, in semiconductor history. I don't know in my whole career as in semiconductors, I don't remember any other time in semiconductor history where any particular vendor had the lead for 3 years in performance. And that lead is translating into a leadership position for digital in the new battlefield of 64-bit computing.
Well, is that coming fast enough?
I mean, well, I'd love to come faster.
Performance lead, right, but having a performance lead is something that digital is free, you know, through its history, is comfortable with, but not always necessarily.
Well, let me phrase it for you.
It's not something translated into the commercial.
There's a couple issues here. One is every time you have an architectural transition from 8 bits to 16, 16 to 32, and now 32 to 64, it takes about 4 or 5 years for that transition to begin to take effect, and for the same reasons, that it takes 4 or 5 years for new applications to show up that fully exploit the extended addressing space. We introduced the Alpha AXP microprocessor on February 10th, 1992. It was in 1995, just recently, April 11th, that we announced the first application, commercial application, with Oracle. Oracle had developed a 64-bit database system called Very Large Memory on our TurboLaser platform that fully exploits the capability of that 64-bit addressing. It took that long, and yet the results are unbelievable. You see orders of magnitude greater performance and database-intensive functionality. That's incredible, and at a fraction of the cost of any other way to do it. I think that augurs extremely well for digital's future. Now, my competitors have not yet shipped 64-bit systems. We will have shipped between $4.5 to $5 billion worth of Alpha systems and services before HP and IBM ship their first 64-bit system. And right now, they're mostly arguing about who's going to be number two. So that's a interesting place to be for digital for the future. Now, it has a cost. The cost is we've made all of that investment without much revenue for the last 3 or 4 years. But there's also a benefit. For the next 3 or 4 years, we're going to start enjoying the benefit of being there first and having the outstanding performance that we have. It's no free lunches. I mean, if you're going to make the investment early, you're going to have the cost without the return, but then you're going to enjoy the return. And it's a very big bet, as you've suggested. It's one that I championed when I was running Semiconductor, and it's one that's going to pay off for this company.
Is that transition to real commercial use, real commercial acceptance of Alpha happening about as fast as you expected?
Well, it's happening.
But it seems to me we've got the impression that it would happen a little bit faster.
Well, there were a lot of analysts that thought it would happen faster, and I would say it's fair to think that digital management thought it would happen faster, including myself. And the reason being that we expected that Microsoft Windows NT would be closer to its original schedule.
Right.
And it was late. Also, when it came out, it was unfortunately required too much memory to fit on the desktop. So that changed the economics associated with Alpha rather dramatically. On the other hand, it is going to happen. And that's very exciting because, as you'll note, next week, Tuesday, at DECUS in Washington, D.C., Digital is going to be announcing further expansion of our strategic relationship with Microsoft, and we'll be talking about the integration of Windows NT and VMS in a more or less seamless environment for our VMS customer base and for anybody else, frankly, that has Windows NT on the desktop that wants to have a bulletproof, reliable, scalable, enterprise-type operating system that VMS is, that's open. It's an outstanding thing. That'll be announced next week, and you're going to see, I think, quite a bit of positive acceptance with that announcement. So it's happening. There's no question Windows NT is going to be successful. It's going to take longer because it was late in its initial implementation.
Well, how disappointing or how damaging is it that they've delayed so long?
Well,
I remember that announcement, too.
I don't know how to quantify any of that, but it's no question that if it came out sooner, we would have enjoyed success sooner on it. In the meantime, we've enjoyed great success with our implementation of 64-bit Unix on our Alpha AXP systems. And, of course, as I mentioned, the TurboLaser that we announced last week, the database running on it's running on Unix, 64 bits. Windows NT is a 32-bit system. So we have our complete offering our competitors really don't have. Most of our competitors have picked one or the other, and they basically tell your customer, well, the answer is Unix, or the answer is Windows NT, or the answer is my proprietary version. And Digital has said that we are able to provide guidance, given your application, for which operating system we would recommend, but we'll support any of them. So it's, like, we'd recommend in some cases it should be Unix, and we prefer Digital 64-bit Unix. Or in some cases you ought to stay with Windows NT, or in some cases, you ought to use a combination of VMS and one of the others. And we'll support any combination of that. So it's a let the marketplace decide approach. And what we're seeing is rapid acceptance today of both Unix and Windows NT.
I wanted to ask a couple of more stratospheric questions, if I could.
Sure.
Where you think the industry is going, or where the models for the business might be changed. Well, I had an interview with Al Zayn at Gillette a year ago. He talked a lot about the globalization of their market and
yes.
how Gillette is truly sees itself as a global company that sells the same.
We're similar in that regard. See, Gillette has, I think, more than half its revenue outside the United States, and so does Digital. We have about 62 to 65%, depending on the quarter, of our revenues outside the United States, half in Europe. And, of course, the rest, about 35% in the U.S., and the rest all over the place. We have been a global company, though, for a very long time. I think is in 1970, we were doing business in 68 countries. So that's a long time ago. So Ken and his management style was to very rapidly deploy digital products across the globe and did an excellent job of it. And it's not an accident that that later fueled digital's growth. We were able to grow dramatically in the 70s and 80s because we had an early presence in many different countries. And again, that was Ken's contribution among many others that he made.
But in terms, is there a change happening?
Yes, there is a change.
There
is a very dramatic change as part of the new organizational structure that I introduced last July. The original structure of doing business in various countries was then to organize digital, very decentralized, by country or territory. And that means that every country had its own infrastructure for that country and probably had its own general ledger, had its own accounting systems for order entry and whatever. That enabled the company to grow very rapidly in the 1970s and 80s, as I mentioned. In the 1990s, we have many customers, the large ones in particular, companies like, let's say, Unilever, ABB, Nestle, companies that do business in hundreds of countries or 100 countries themselves and have maybe 500 subsidiaries. And what they want to look at is an IT partner that can look at their business on a global basis. So we could look at ABB as a global account, not as ABB in Switzerland, ABB here, ABB there. And so in Digital's case, we are organizing that way. Our top direct accounts, our top 1,000 accounts, are organized by account, not by geography. And we are in the process of making that transition. Let me give you a chance to change that.
Draw a breath if you'd like.
Good. Sure. That is a characteristic of me. I talk too fast.
No, that's one reason I decided to dig up the...